Where, I wonder, in nature are you drawn? To what are you drawn in a natural setting? Now, there are some people who are town folk and city folk, but even amongst them, many of us are drawn to natural places. And there are different kinds of people, kind of like cat people and dog people. People that are drawn to the oceans and the beaches and the shore. There are even people drawn to the still, sunny, quiet desert places. And there are the mountain and forest people. I am a mountain and forest kind of person. Now, while I don't get to the mountains all that often, since I'm not a skier or a snowboarder, that's just way too sporty for me, I do enjoy an occasional trip to the mountains. And I recall what I think was my second trip to Mount Hood, our own close by beautiful mountain top. It was during one of the early visits of my mother. And my mother, as you are probably aware if you've been around, comes in the winter, around November, sometimes after Christmas, depends upon which year it is. And my mother was visiting, and we decided to go on a trip to Mount Hood. Now, on the valley floor, it was a lovely winter day, very little, if you know, any snow, actually, that I can recall. And we took the beautiful drive out through Hood River and then up the mountain. Now, you're laughing already. What's that about? I grew up in the Northeast. I grew up with snow. I knew what was going on. Okay. Well, as we began our ascent to Mount Hood, things began to change. The weather on the valley floor was giving way to the weather of the mountain, and as we wound our way up further and further, the snow was deeper and deeper and was falling heavier and heavier. And we were just not sure my Prius, without chains, was quite going to make it the whole way to the lodge. But there really wasn't anywhere to turn around. We were committed. So we made it the whole way to Timberline Lodge, and the snow was coming down hard and heavy by that time. So as hardy as Mom and I are, and we are rather hardy souls, we decided we were wise enough to realize how very ill-prepared we were for what the mountain had in store for us that day. So we ran into the lodge, peed, went right back to the car, right back down the mountain. Not even time enough for a hot chocolate. It was exciting and disappointing all at the same time. I also recall another trip to mountains that I made probably 20 years or so ago. And I think I've mentioned this briefly in the past. It was a longer and a much more memorable trip. It was a personal pilgrimage, in fact. It was the pilgrimage I took to the Bristlecone Pine Forest in the White Mountains of the Sierra Nevada range of mountains in California, kind of central and northern-ish in the Sierra Nevadas. Now, the Bristlecone Pines are accessible only between May and November because of the elevation. They're at about 10 to 11,000 feet up in the mountains. So from Los Angeles, I drove several hours and stayed overnight in a small motel in Bishop, California. I drove early in the morning up the mountain. I had checked weather incessantly, and this was pre-internet, so I had to call in the weather on the phone all the time just to find out if it was going to be open, because even though I was in June, it often would close due to snow. I had packed myself a little lunch. I had a thermos full of hot tea because it was early in the morning. I was really well prepared. Now, when you hear the word forest, you probably do not quite visualize the Bristlecone Pine Forest, because at that elevation, it is very high, it is very dry, and it is very rocky. It actually looks a bit like a lunar landscape with these twisted, craggy, stump-like looking trees growing out of it. Very little else grows at that elevation with them. And you wouldn't necessarily even know that these are living trees. They look like dead stumps, except there's a thin line of bark that leads to these little tufts of needles. It is bitterly cold and hot, and virtually nothing else will grow in that alkaline soil. The bristlecone pines are the oldest living single organisms on our planet. The so-called Methuselah tree in the forest has been dated at 4,700 years old. Now that may be a figure that's hard to get our heads around, 4,700 years. But think about it. This Methuselah tree was a living seedling when our European ancestors were using hand axes. It was alive and growing when the cornerstones of the oldest pyramids were being laid. When Moses stood barefoot at the burning bush, this tree's branches were already reaching towards the sun. And 1,000 years before the first letter of Hebrew scripture was etched on a scroll, 1,000 years before sacred text, the seedling children of this tree were already growing alongside it. To be in the presence of such a thing is to be on holy ground. I was only able to stay a couple of hours, but I will forever remember my pilgrimage. Old things and young things at the same time. And I don't mean necessarily old people in this room, but you know who you are. But you know who you are, you know who you are. Not quite bristlecone age, but perhaps bristly. Mountains inspire us from a distance, perhaps because of their scale or their austere beauty. But to be on them is inspiring in a different way. To be at a mountain itself is inspiring in a different way. And there are a few observations just that I'll make quickly about why it's inspiring to be on a mountain for me. First, it's inspiring because it's a place that is away from our daily human living, with very few exceptions, perhaps the Sherpas in the Himalayas, who for generations and lifetimes live at such high elevation. They are apart from human daily life, and it takes great effort to get there. It's not our common place. Second, we don't or we can't live there. The resources that are needed for human life are scarce at best or completely absent. The higher and higher you go, the less and less oxygen and water and food is available. Whether we're well prepared or unprepared, we can only visit for a short time. And the third thing is this, but when you get to the mountaintop, you see things that you cannot see anywhere else. Maybe it's something unique that exists only there, like a 4,700-year-old tree, or gaze upon the world with a transformed perspective, a vista you cannot see anywhere else. Today's gospel story is one of many mountaintop stories from Scripture. And I think of all the strange and amazing stories in this collection of strange and amazing stories that we call the Bible, today's story, called the Transfiguration, is surely among the stranger stories about Jesus. This is the last week before we enter the season of preparation for Easter called Lent. And at this end of the aha season of Epiphany, we have this peculiar Transfiguration Sunday. And in a way, it's a culmination of all of those Epiphany manifestations of Christ, the Epiphany and the Theophany, if you recall recent sermons. This scene is called the Transfiguration because of how it is the appearance of Jesus was changed, was transfigured. It's a story that is in Matthew and Luke as well, but in this, in Mark's version of the story, the scene follows a memorable conversation when Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do you think I am?" And if you recall that conversation, Peter affirms him as the Messiah. Then Jesus goes on to say how he is going to suffer and die. The same Peter says, "Oh, surely not." And then Jesus shockingly rebukes Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan." That's the prelude to this mountaintop experience. 6 days later, is what Mark says, we have this story. There's this kind of buildup, even a struggle, to communicate and clarify who Jesus is and what he had come to do. They get it and they don't get it, because they weren't accustomed to seeing who and what he was. And the story describes how this inner circle, the select three disciples, go up to an unnamed mountain. Traditionally, it's considered Mount Tabor. Not here, by the way. Yeah. Although, you never know what you might find if you go up our Mount Tabor. They go up this unnamed mountain and they witness this astonishing meeting. They experience a vision or a visitation of sorts. Two great symbolic figures from Hebrew and Jewish history. Two figures who, just between the two of them, sum up the entirety of their people's tradition, the law and the prophets, summed up in two individuals: Moses, that great liberator from the bondage, the lawbringer who went up a mountain to receive the law from God; Elijah, the greatest of all the prophets, who went up a mountain and met the presence of God, the one for whom a cup is still kept at every Passover, even to this day. On this mountain, we are not sure how, but they recognize that these two pivotal spiritual figures that encapsulate the whole of their history are conferring with their own friend and teacher, Jesus, who now himself is suddenly radiant with the presence of God. Jesus is actually described with the same language that the Holy of Holies in the temple is described with when the presence of God descends, the same Holy of Holies language. And if that was not enough, just like what happened at his baptism by John the Baptizer in the Jordan, a voice from heaven confirms Jesus once again, "This is my beloved child. Listen." Now, it's an odd story that might distance us in some ways, but the original audience could not have understood it more powerfully or more clearly. The teaching, preaching, healing Jesus that they were hearing about, that they were reading about, is the embodiment of all that you have been waiting for. This is God's chosen and beloved. Listen, pay attention. So in the middle of this, Peter's response is striking, almost silly. He fumbles at an attempt at hospitality in this overwhelming and amazing moment. Mark says they were terrified. Peter is awkward, but it's so understandable. These guys, this moment is so big, so important. We have to do something. Here, have a seat. Let me build you a house. What's happening is so awesome. Let's keep it here. Mountaintop experiences don't work that way, do they? They don't come when we call. When we have a powerful mountaintop experience, don't we want to capture it too? We want to repeat it over and over again. We want to make a shrine to contain it. We want to build a memorial. We want to light a candle whenever we visit. We want to press it between the pages of a book so our children and grandchildren will know. But when we grasp and hold and try to keep this revelation of a life-giving spirit, trying to turn it into a souvenir suitable for framing, it doesn't work. The truth is, most of our life is not and cannot be lived on the mountaintop. Mountaintop experiences are memorable and transformational, but they're not about to sit still for you to take a selfie. And they are not repeatable at our convenience. They imprint themselves upon our souls. Each year, I find it really helpful to recall that while for many of us, this transfiguration story is kind of an odd side story, maybe a secondary theme in the story of Jesus, unless you come from an Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition, this is a scene and a story that's significance is only exceeded. Only one other story is believed more important, and that is the resurrection itself. Western Christianity, Roman Catholicism in particular, has tended to emphasize suffering and crucifixion as a bigger theme. Orthodox Christianity, our sisters and brothers in the East, see this transfiguration as the primary symbol of spiritual life. This brilliant, radiant energy of God shines through the humanity of Jesus on the mountaintop. And it's not just about Jesus. It's the goal and the possibility of every human life. That's Orthodox theology. It has its own theological word called theosis. That through this person and work of Jesus, through God's grace, our own spiritual journey is more and more infused by this radiant energy, making us more and more like God. Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration is not a great exception, but to be viewed as a great example. I think in that light, the poem we heard by Malcolm Geet captures this outer and inner aspect with such language, I think it's worth hearing once more. For that one moment in and out of time, on that one mountain where all moments meet, the daily veil that covers the sublime in darkling glass fell dazzled at his feet. There were no angels full of eyes and wings, just living glory full of truth and grace. The love that dances at the heart of things shone out upon us from a human face. And to that light, the light in us leaped up. We felt it quicken somewhere deep within. A sudden blaze of long extinguished hope trembled and tingled through the tender skin. Nor can this blackened sky, this darkened scar, eclipse the glimpse of how things really are. Between the ahas of Epiphany and the spiritual work of Lent, we get a moment on the mountain. It is a place apart. It's not a place we can stay forever. But we glimpse something of how things really are, something that is always with us, and something that changes us forever.